Welcome to the Glenn Show, Harold. Glenn Lowry here, BloggingHeads.tv, Brown University, with my friend Harold Pollack, University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, and frequent guest at the Glenn Show. So, Harold, in the world of public health, we're going to talk public health, we're going to talk politics, we're going to talk moral sanction and memory and religion. In the world of public health, what's going on in Chicago that's interesting?
Well, let's see. I guess there's a couple of things going on in Chicago. Our crime rate is down, but it's not down as much as we had hoped. And there's a lot of conversation about it. And we continue to see these tremendous disparities across neighborhoods in Chicago in violence rates that are concerning and that make violence, actually a very rare phenomenon in much of the city. And yet we have very high homicide rates comparatively in the south and west sides of the city. And
well, that's a perennial truth about urban life, is it not? I mean, isn't something like half of the homicides that occur Black men below the age of 35 as both perpetrators and victims? I mean, some number on that scale?
Yeah.
You might know the aggregate statistics better. I'm talking about nationally. I'm talking about murder rates.
You know. No, it's quite disproportionate. And it's certainly true in Chicago. The homicide rates among non-Hispanic whites are extremely low, and the homicide rates among Latinos are also pretty low. And so it is, it is significant to a significant extent, concentrated among young African American men, and of course the gun issue is a big part of that too. That it is really hard to deal with that problem with the ready availability of handguns to the to the extent that they're available when you can, we're working on ways to try to seal that off, but. The perennial issues are there.
Do you really think that perhaps I shouldn't put it that way? I want to raise two different kind of questions. You started out saying there was variation across neighborhoods in the incidence of violence. Yeah. And then we acknowledged that there was a racial gender age gradient that accounted for a whole lot of the variation. Why even look at it in terms of neighborhoods? Because it's not really, it's not really neighborhoods that we're talking about, or is it? And then the other thing is, you say availability of guns, so that's an environmental factor. If only we could keep the guns out of their hands. Are we really dealing with whatever the cultural dynamic is that allows psychocultural, whatever, you want to make it economic and political, okay, we can, but those are starting to feel to me like second order issues relative to whatever it is that's going on that causes the rates of violence to be so order of magnitude disproportionately high in this identifiable demographic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you see the question that I'm raising. Let's not dodge the issue. Black men under the age of 35 are killing each other. And that's not the NRA's fault.
No, it's not the NRA's fault. On the other hand, if you compare American cities to many Canadian and European cities, what you find is similar rates of interpersonal violence on everything that doesn't involve guns. So, I mean, it really is true that the guns are a distinctive moderating thing that's going on here, that, the guns are not the only issue. But I can tell you that there are many, I've looked at case reports of many, many homicides where you have, conflict between young people that just would not have led to a death if somebody wasn't carrying a gun. And, we really do have, the guns really are a significant, distinct issue. They're not
okay, but
so it's not the only issue.
Guns are out there.
Mm-hmm.
But those guns are out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not supposed to be about guns, but I really do think this point is important. And if I'm wrong, I need to be corrected. How the hell are you going to get the hundreds of millions of firearms that are in private hands out of them? And as long as they're there, how the hell are you going to inhibit people who want to get their hands on them from getting them.
Well,
and since there is both a constitutional provision and a very powerful lobby concerned about the extent to which whatever it is that you might do might infringe upon their liberties, are we not fiddling while Rome burns to the extent that we worry about keeping guns out of the hands of gangbangers who are determined to do violence to one another?
Well, it's a complicated thing because it's true there's a lot of guns out there, and that might lead us to be very pessimistic. On the other hand, we have a lot of evidence that a lot of criminals have difficulty actually getting access to guns, and that many of the crimes that are committed with guns are committed by people who don't have a legal right to have one, by the NRA's preferred legal framework, and that there's a lot we can do to interfere with that thin market for guns that may be effective. We've been talking to people in jails who are gun offenders to try to understand not only where they get their guns, but why are they carrying their guns around in situations when violence might occur? Because, if someone has a gun, especially if you have a 19-year-old guy and he's got a gun, but he keeps it hidden behind grandma's house because he's afraid that he's going to get caught with it. And then he gets into it on the street because some guy is looking at his girlfriend. Well, he doesn't have that gun in his waistband to pull out and shoot that other guy. And, there's a lot that you can do to...
Well, sure. I mean, you can have magnetometers on police officers. Mm-hmm. You could probably even devise a mechanism that would allow them at some distance to determine whether or not a person had a heavy metal object on their person by scanning them. And then you might be able to reduce the number of guns around the street. Maybe this is worth doing. I don't know. Maybe the imposition on liberty associated with that would be over the line. I don't know. But I still want an answer to my question. What the heck is going on with these guys? Yeah. This is aberrant. This endangers everybody, or does it? Certainly it generates a perception of unsettling unsafety.
Yeah, no, well, there's...
And, to get technocratic about it, when in fact we've got such a aberrant and deeply disturbing pattern of behavior being manifest in our society. I mean, who gets held accountable for that? There got to be enough failures to go around. It can't just be policy as
well. Well, I think there's, if you name your suspect, it's a little bit like the murder on the Orient Express, where there's a ton of suspects and they're all guilty. I think that pretty much anything that someone identifies as a potential issue has played some role. A culture of violence plays some role. Lack of opportunity plays a big role. Family issues play a big role. I mean, I must say what I'm focused on is much more, what are the interventions that we can do that would be helpful? And we know that summer youth employment can be helpful. My colleague Sarah Heller was the principal investigator on a study that I was involved in that showed that you could reduce arrests for violent offenses if you gave young people jobs over the summer with some help to do well in those jobs. We know that mentoring programs can be effective. There's a number of things that can be helpful. And I think that it's actually much – the right way to think about this problem is not to fight about, which ultimate cause is really the true cause, but to say, what do we know how to do that can be helpful? I do think that we tend to hold local policymakers overly accountable for these problems, and that we've had national policy failures that make themselves felt in the neighborhoods of the South Side of Chicago, where you have the foreclosure crisis, where you have incredibly high rates of unemployment, and so on, we really have to deal with this as a nation, and we have a national policy failure on guns too. So I would say let's focus on in a methodical way on what seems to be helpful, rather than to try to get in. I think this sort of culture war type debates that we were in, didn't lead us to effective policies.
Well, but I don't think that's what I'm suggesting. I agree with that. And I take it that the cities have their problems. I mean, and it's certainly not Rahm Emanuel's fault, for example, that there's a lot of killings in Chicago in the South Side and the West Side. Mm-hmm. But here's what I'm saying. However tough times might be, you so value the life of another human being that you're willing to snuff it out? I mean, and that behavior is manifest with a frequency in some quarters of our society that are highly specific and identifiable to a vastly greater extent than elsewhere. So that, I mean, I'm just sort of drawing attention back onto that because, you know, I'm not proposing this as a solution, but there does seem to be a values problem here. I mean, I'm not saying go preach to people, but I'm saying taking a life is a really extraordinary thing.
Well, you know, I agree with that and I disagree with that. I definitely think that there is a value, there is this values issue, and there is, you know, it's no coincidence to me that the effective intervention that I was involved with was called Becoming a Man and dealt with a lot of the issues that young men face that, you know, that feed into when violence is an appropriate response to, you know, to another person's disrespect for you and so on. But I also think that there's the concept of Nash equilibrium here among young people that makes their values seem much more pathological than they actually are. You know, if you're a 19-year-old young man and you're walking around in East Garfield Park or in Englewood, you're in a pretty tough environment and you have to behave in a way that is different from the way Harold Pollack behaves walking around his environment. And looked at from the outside, you know, from the outside, it looks more pathological than it is lived. And, you know, it is, you know, I live in an environment where I'm highly secure in my person and I don't have to, you know, my capacity for personal violence is just not important, and doesn't have to be demonstrated. And so when I talk to young people, you know, the ultimate values that people express seem very similar to the kinds of values that I have and my kids have and so on. It's their ability to navigate the world that they're in that really puts those values to the test. And if I sit down with a group of boys, some of whom have been arrested, some of whom had all sorts of issues, they're all saying, yeah, the violence here is really bad. I'm so glad that you're here working on this problem. You know, my cousin was shot. I'm worried about it. But this is the life that I'm in, and it's a pretty tough life. And, you know, you're the shrimpy, nerdy guy, and it's not a problem for you, but that's not the way my life, you know, can go.
Okay. So let me take a point of privilege as an economics professor, because I was playing devil's advocate to a certain extent earlier in this conversation by saying, oh, what's up with these young black guys? I do think there are some issues there, you know, a few more fathers with exerting demonstrable guiding hand of maturity and responsibility in their lives might not hurt, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I believe that for a long time. But I think you're making a really fundamental point, and I want to underscore it, and I say point of privilege as an economics professor because I see the model. I see exactly how this works. So the point you're making is in an interactive system, there's more than one level of behavior, in this case, violence, that's sort of mutually consistent with rationality, more than one level in a given community. It could be a low level of, you know, the use of violence against other people. And given that it's a low level, that is an environment in which most people would be prepared to restrain from violence. Or it may be a high level. And given that it's a high level, that's an environment in which the very same types of people with the very same values would feel themselves rationally impelled to use violence. And the model that I see has, it's just very simple. On the horizontal, there's the number of people believed to be carrying guns. And on the vertical, there's the fraction of the population who would want to carry given that that number was believed to be carried. Okay. So I see a curve relating these two things. As more people are believed to be carrying, more people will cross over a threshold of their own personal safety concern that will lead them to carry. And where that curve cuts across the 45-degree line, we're going to have stable rates of carry in the community. There's no reason why it can't cross that line at more than one point, which means there's no reason why the same values couldn't be consistent with either a low or a high level of the carrying of weapons and the use of those weapons in a given community. End of lecture. But you
is
see what
that,
I mean?
I think there's a, is it Russell Cooper has that paper? There's a paper that's often cited in the New Keynesian economics literature that's sort of coming into focus on multiple equilibria that I think you're right. By the way, one of the issues where some of the broader social issues come into play is I think there's a lot of reason to think if we could focus specifically on the guns, we could actually do some good. Now, part of what that requires is treating young people who are carrying guns pretty stringently so that we can ratchet up the cost of carrying a gun around. That is a very hard sell in the communities that are most at risk from these guns because of the over-incarceration experience we've had in the drug war. And one of the...
You got evidence. I guess I got to ask you this. You've got evidence that the proclivity to carry a gun is responsive to the incentives created by toughening the penalties for being caught with guns?
We have some evidence.
Because I want to see
that
evidence.
We have some evidence for that. It's imperfect evidence for that. There's evidence. There's been some studies of gun patrols in Pittsburgh, for example, where in particular places they would ratchet up the intensity of gun enforcement. And what you would see is fewer gunshot wounds. You know, Jens Ludwig has a paper on that. We also, from our interviews, when we talk to people, it's very clear people feel very clearly, that they'll express the sentiment, I'd rather get caught with my gun than without my gun. And the deterrent message is a little fuzzy if you get caught with your gun, but you haven't committed any other crime. And you compare that with the high cost to you of getting caught without your gun when you really need it. And so I don't think the evidence is dispositive. But I think that we have a variety of evidence that suggests that it's a promising approach to think that increasing the certainty of apprehension may be helpful. And certainly the New York experience is one.
Well, wait a minute, because the first point you made was about the penalty. Now you're talking about the certainty of apprehension, which is a different thing. Certainty of apprehension doesn't have to lead to a whole lot of people going to jail, but a mandatory minimum sentence or a tack on of 10 years or prosecutorial discretion to ratchet it up to some mandatory minimum, which gets them to plead to something, could be adding 3, 4, 5, 7 years to the amount of time somebody.
Yeah, in general, I'm much more.
And that's the thing I want to know whether there's evidence. That's what I want to know, whether or not there's evidence that lengthening the sentences in a way that would materially affect the rate of incarceration in a community would deter people.
I think there's much better. There's much more reason to think that increasing the certainty of apprehension would be good than there is that there's evidence that increasing the length of the term is good. I think that I in general, am not a big fan of long terms. I think that the human cost is so high and the evidence that they actually give us a lot of crime benefit is pretty low for most things. So I would much rather see more people being reliably captured and sentenced to shorter terms than I would like to see these long terms being imposed. And I think these long terms also undermine the legitimacy of the system in the eyes of many people. And I think we're on the same side, perhaps, of that.
Yeah, let's talk about something else. You had a commentary or something about Pope Francis at Yad Vashem. And I had a reaction of, how was it, diffidence or kind of not sharing your sense of moral outrage?
Well, I think your word was annoying. You found it annoying. The Pope, I'm a...
Tiresome. No. The word was not annoying. The word was tiresome. That's different.
There, I think we both admire greatly Pope Francis in all sorts of ways, and certainly if he can be helpful in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, you know, we all would welcome that. But it's funny, and he spoke to the Palestinians and he spoke to Israelis and was very moving. He said all the right things to some Holocaust survivors, and he talked about the suffering of Palestinians and of Israelis who are the victims of terrorist attacks. And then he goes and he gives a speech at Yad Vashem, and I was actually jarred by it. At first I liked it, and then I thought about it. I thought, I don't like this so much. And in a way it was because I was thinking about some of the issues that Ta-Nehisi Coates talked about in the reparations essays that he's written, that there's probably no spot on the planet Earth where a pope has less moral standing than at Yad Vashem, because really he showed up as an individual pilgrim of goodwill, offering his mediation to both sides and his own moral authority. But he's also, He's the leader of an institution which failed dramatically during the Holocaust, and which has never really owned up to the depth of the misconduct that Pope Pius was a party to, and that the Pope should,
okay,
you know, that
me,
the, if the Pope is
question.
At that spot, he has to somehow engage that, it seemed to me. And so I was dissatisfied.
Okay. Let me mm-hmm. ask you a question. Mm-hmm. here's my question. So there's the Catholic Church, and it's a piece of work. I'm sure that, you know, there's a lot that could be said. There's a lot that mm-hmm. could be said that would be profoundly critical and would raise all kind of yep. moral questions. It's to be judged. We're going to judge the moral authority of the Pope, of the Prince of the Catholic Church, based upon how the church reacted to the events of 1933 to 1945. I mean, really? That becomes the fulcrum of his moral standing? I mean, whatever the merits of the argument about what was and was not done, isn't it a bit presumptuous or even tiresome that someone would pronounce upon his moral authority based upon that? That becomes the fulcrum of the moral authority of the Catholic Church? That seems to be a little bit presumptuous to me. I mean, without, if I have to say it, and I will say it, without in any way taking away from the Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about the slavery, reparation, the injury or whatnot. I mean, I can relate to the idea of a sense of moral outrage, of grievance, of victimization, and of a demand for a recognition of the claim that is deep-seated and that lasts over generations, over mm-hmm. centuries. But I don't think the Catholic Church is rightly judged, or I don't think that this Pope's moral authority on the world stage to do so much good. No place that he has less moral authority when he stands at Yad Vashem. You know, as I say, and I'll say it just for the final time, it seems to me a bit presumptuous that that would be taken to be the fulcrum of the judgment of the moral authority.
Well, let me respond in a couple of ways to that. One is that he's in the process of, you know, there's a process of sainthood going on for Pope Pius XII. And so the church itself is choosing to sanctify the behavior, you know, the man who is in question. And so issue number one is that they have themselves identified with this. And the second is that in some ways the church's behavior in the Holocaust is really a stalking horse for some of the big issues within the church about the reforms of Vatican II. And to the extent that we as a religion, as an institution, can frankly and transparently address our own shortcomings. And this is 70 years ago now. It's not as if there's individuals who are now in authority in the church who are personally culpable in the way, you know, this is not like the child abuse scandal. This is really a question: can we confront our own history in an honest way? And actually, I'm a huge fan of Vatican II. I think it is. I wish that every, you know, I think it's a remarkable act of self-reflection and reform. So there's a lot that's at stake here. And I do think that you know, if you're standing at Yad Vashem, it does, you know, a third of the Jews in the world were murdered in the living memory of a hell of a lot of people. And it's not that the church should pay reparations for that, or that the church bears primary responsibility, but I think that they do owe just an honest accounting of what happened and what was our role in this. What was our role in returning? You know, I mean, there's just a lot of issues that that come up. You know, the after the war, the church hindered the return of baptized Jewish yeah. Children to their families. There's just a lot that's going on there, And if you're in that spot, it is appropriate for people to say, "Hey, what happened?" You know, it's
Let's not get into. There are too many points on the table. I'd like to have an mm-hmm. opportunity to respond. I saw what you wrote about the failure of the church to return mm-hmm. baptized children, and I thought that issue reminded me of the adoption of the children of Native American families by white Americans in the United States and the brouhahas that have arisen over that, you know, communal claims on children.
Very much so, yes. Time.
You know, birth, is the child identified by the birth, you know, by blood and this kind of thing. So those questions are not at all obvious to me what the right answers are. Certainly not so obvious that one has a right to moral condemnation of another for having a different point of view about it. But I wanted to make a different point. You say there's no place where the Pope of the Catholic Church has less authority than Yad Vashem, given the way the church behaved during the war, during the Holocaust.
I should say, by the way, that the many people in the church behaved quite heroically, and it's really, I mean, I can't make a blanket statement about millions and millions of people and many, many religious figures, but the Pope and many, and there's an aspect that needs to be, so I don't want, I just need to put that caveat there. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, no problem. I'm not going to forget what I was trying to say, which was that you know, mischievous pundit might say, there's no place on earth other than, there's no place where a person has less authority to say that a person has moral authority than standing in the shadow of this occupation that's been perpetrated now for decades and witnessing the domination of these people who've been rendered stateless and refugee status for nearly three quarters of a century, who were not allowed to come back to their homes after they were dispersed during the chaos of conflict. No place where a person has less authority to wax about the moral authority of somebody than in the shadow of that occupation.
Well, I guess I would say that, you know, my neighbor up the street in Rochester who was hidden in his house, you know, he's no more responsible for the mistreatment of the Palestinians than his plight, than it's appropriate to cite his plight as a way to justify the mistreatment of Palestinians. I think that those issues are really quite separate. In fact, I think the fact that you found it tiresome in part is a reaction to the use of the Holocaust as a rhetorical and political device over a long period of time, you know, in the context of the Arab-Israeli conflict, which we're really, these are really quite separate issues. And
I don't think they're separate, though, Harold. I see what you mean. I agree that that there is this reaction from a lot of people, myself included, to the deployment of the victimization of the Jews on behalf of certain political or ideological objectives, which are questionable on their face. I agree with that. But I don't see how you can say that I certainly, and moreover, giving me my caveat, I wouldn't say that the person who had to hide to keep from being shipped in a freight car to an industrial death camp and managed to survive, although his entire family may have gotten wiped out, needs to have his claim on our attention qualified by whatever it is that his co-religionists might or might not be doing in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. No. His right to my attention is every bit as compelling regardless. Mm-hmm. I would agree to that. But when Benjamin Netanyahu says that this or that cannot be allowed to happen, I don't know whether it has to do with Iran, whether it has to do with Hamas, whether it has to do with the Hezbollah or whatever, because we're not going to allow another Holocaust to be perpetrated. When he says that the ingathering of the Jewish people in the Jewish state is a necessity and an opposition to the prerogatives of that state is, in effect, a kind of visitation of some second Holocaust upon the Jewish people. How can I not equate those things?
I don't think that we have to accept Netanyahu's framing of that. And I mean, I you know, we can have a separate conversation about the Arab-Israeli conflict, but I think that I think it's important to keep those issues separate, and that, you know, I don't think that it's appropriate. I think the Holocaust is a terrible framing to think about. You know, the apocalyptic nature of the Holocaust is as a political symbol can easily lead people to the rejection of negotiation with their adversaries and to a, you know, and to a sort of Manichaean view of you know, contemporary politics and you know, power diplomacy. And I certainly would reject that. But I think it is you know, I just think that I would keep that separate. And, you know, Israelis and Palestinians have enough on their plate to find a way to live together decently, you know, without the Holocaust being, you know, without the Holocaust being brought in, you know, into that discussion. And I think that, and to the extent that I think part of, I mean, it is true that as part of the Israeli psyche and the Jewish psyche that the Holocaust happened. And I think one has to honor the Holocaust as a historic event, and to appreciate why Israelis and Jews around the world are so scarred by it. But I think that I would love to see the Holocaust removed from contemporary political disputes as much as possible, and just, you know.
Well, so here's the thing. Here's the thing. So, but for the Holocaust and the memory of it, the legitimacy of the Zionist claim, I mean, the, as it were, right of the state of Israel to exist. I'm not questioning that right. But you hear what I'm saying. I'm saying there was a transformation. I mean, the international community, the global powers, I mean, it all had to come to be understood to be legitimate. Claim is, it seems to me, fundamentally rooted in the victimization of Jewish people by the Nazis and so forth in that period. So, I, you know, otherwise, the ethnocentrism, I've got a nation state defined in terms of race, basically, and whatnot, and the need to maintain a Jewish majority in the state. These are all just taken as political claims on their face, extraordinary. It's only the historical specificity of the victimization of the Jewish people that makes those claims tenable, it seems to me. And the behavior of the state of Israel in the post-1967 period has come very close to it seems to me, squandering that moral capital, or at least placing it in grave jeopardy.
Well, excuse me for the rant. Israel is an expression of, includes Jewish nationalism and the aspiration for a Jewish nation state, you know, on the land of Israel. It's, I think its legitimacy, I mean, it exists as a country. It is, we can have a whole discussion about whether France or Belgium or Israel or many of the places should exist. It's there. It's appropriate to judge Israel's treatment of its non-Jewish minority and of Palestinians by standards of human rights, and it is.
I just want to make clear, Harold. I'm not questioning whether or not Israel has a right to exist. I'm saying that from, I don't know, 1920 or whenever. I mean, that's not the beginning of Zionism, but it's very early on. To the day that we stand, that it has come to exist, through whatever processes of legitimation had to occur, had a great deal to do with the victimization of
Jewish
people.
Yes. Yeah, no, it certainly did.
That's what I'm
saying. It's a historic fact. That
so
is
yes,
true.
Yes, indeed it does. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed it does exist. It has come to exist. But I also say that the legitimacy of the ongoing project is still in question. I mean, the delegitimization of South African apartheid unfolded over a period of time. There was a time where it was not as illegitimate as it came to be seen. And all of the churning that's going on in the United Nations General Assembly, the Presbyterian Church, the far left wing of this or that European party and so on, and on college campuses all over the place, there's an open argument ongoing about legitimacy of the occupation, legitimacy of the policies, et cetera. And so it's not as if that conversation is over. It's not trying to wipe Israel off the map to observe that that's a conversation that's
sure. Happened. And I think Israel has to reckon with that. And, but I just think that is what matters for that is, you know, how are they behaving towards, towards the Palestinians, and what realistic prospects are there for Israelis and Palestinians to negotiate a just, you know, a just settlement of their claims. And I don't know that I have any. I don't know that I have any much. Maybe we should move on because I just don't know that I have. Okay.
Let's move on. What's next on our list?
So I've retired from the presidential politics game. I don't know if that's.
Oh yeah, I was interested in
also,
that.
Also, you know, as you know, since late 2007, I was I was involved in a very passionate and energetic way in the Obama campaign, and you know, I gave thousands of dollars to the campaign. I knocked on hundreds and hundreds of doors, made lots and lots of phone calls, did all sorts of things, and identified myself with a candidate who then became president, etc. And it was great. I was happy I did that, although it brought pluses and minuses to me in all sorts of ways. I'm done with that. I'm not going to pick a candidate in 2016, and I'm going to try not to get sucked into the presidential primaries at all. And I've decided that that my energies are much better spent not identifying with a candidate. And I don't know how you approach these things, but
okay. Well, you know, I didn't do what you did in 2007. I didn't get on a bandwagon. I did give some money to President Obama's campaign during the primary season, but because a friend asked me to, and it seemed a reasonable thing to do. But I didn't, get swept up with the prospect. So I'm not like you. I'm not a joiner of political campaigns. I didn't knock on any doors. I'm not, fretting about all of that stuff. I'm a little bit more removed from it. But I think I will follow the election. I'm just wondering what happened. Mm-hmm. I guess you invite us to ask this as you tell us that you're not doing what you had been doing. What happened to change your disposition?
Well, one thing is, when you watch President Obama's struggles, it's really not all about who's president. I have three issues that I care a lot about. I care a lot about making sure that everyone gets health insurance, which is really states accepting, the Medicaid expansion and health reform. I care about resisting efforts to hinder low-income and minority people from voting. I care a lot about disability issues and making sure that there's adequate social provision for people who live with disabilities. And pretty much any Democrat who's president, it's going to be pretty good about those in terms of my own personal lights. And I think we need to take a page from the book of the Tea Party, actually, and say, the really important action is in Congress. It's in state and local politics. It's in the boring stuff that progressives actually suck at. We get very excited about who's going to be president, and we all turn out for the presidential election. And what's really important is the actual blocking and tackling at the grassroots level that's not about presidential politics. And I think the Morrow Mondays movement is really inspiring, okay. and they can probably use my help more than Hillary Clinton can at this point. So that's one reason why I'm retiring from that.
Okay.
Yes, please.
May I respond? You have other reasons. I'd love to hear them, but I'm responding now to your reason of, maybe it's working in other venues is more influential because the president can't get that much done given what it's been, the way in which Obama has been hamstrung. And my response to that is, it seems to me that you're letting Obama off too easily. You're letting President Obama off too easily in doing that. And that maybe it's he who let you down. You say there's not so much that one person can do. Well, maybe he was just much better at selling the idea of doing something than he was at actually doing something. Maybe he turns out not to have been much of a leader. I mean, I know that you're very profoundly moved by the accomplishment of the healthcare law as being of a historic expansion of the safety net. And I see the possibility for that as law seems to be working. Notwithstanding the bad rollout. We will see what happens because evidently the Republicans aren't through yet, but it does look like they're fighting a losing hand to the extent that they're trying to keep the incremental extension of the welfare state, which was affected by the Affordable Care and Patient Protection Act, from being accomplished. It looks like it is being accomplished. So that's not nothing. That's definitely something. But looking across a broad array of arenas in which the potential for something really significant by way of leadership to happen hasn't happened. And then environmental regulation with respect to immigration law, with respect to these wars have been unwound, but the management of the, you know, sort of visionary management of the portfolio of Americans' global interest into the 21st century doesn't seem to be handled very deftly here. He hasn't risen to the task. He's not the great man that a lot of people had hoped and believed that he was. And that's the problem. Why ascribe it to the impossibility of getting something done when one might more credibly ascribe it to the ineffectiveness of getting anything
well,
done?
Well, by the way, I have some other reasons we'll get to. I think there's a couple of things. One is, you know, it's certainly true that President Obama's made mistakes. I think that the mortgage, the area of home foreclosures and dealing with the
I forgot to mention that
something that was within his control to have done a better job on, and he certainly, you know, failed to use all of the tools that were at his disposal as effectively as he should have. But most of the issues that I care a lot about, and you mentioned immigration, you mentioned environment, a lot of those are things where what's really needed is for grassroots and congressional politics to both create the opportunity and also to create the pressure and the demand to do these things. So, you know, is Obama perfect? No. I think especially in some of the management functions of the executive branch, there's certainly things he could have done better. On the other hand, he's run a pretty scandal-free administration. He passed the health care law.
A lot of people would disagree with that.
I mean, I think that it's been run at a level – I think the level of sort of personal integrity of himself and so on, given that he's been subject to proctological probing by a Republican opposition machine, he's done pretty well.
No question about that.
He's imperfect, but I think he's basically – you know, is he great – is he – you know, is he Abraham Lincoln? No. But he's been pretty good. And I think that he's just not the issue. And I think that and he's also not where I can make and finding the right replacement for him is not okay.
No, I disagree with you, Harold. I think he's done a poor job. I think it's not just administrative. I think he's failed to lead the country. I think he's failed to create the environment in which he might have been able to get more practical things done through Congress and whatnot. I think he's failed to articulate a vision. I mean, whether it's about what are we doing in the winding down of the war on terror, or whether it's about how do the rents get divided when you have financial bubbles that burst and cyclical ups and downs. And you know, I mean, it's much more tactical politics. You know, I got a wedge issue here. I've got a slight margin there. I'm going to frame the issue this way. I'm going to package it that way, and much less of what a grand political vision might look like. I mean, there's very little Obama-esque, Obama doctrine, Obama insight, Obama whatever. When I compare him to Richard Nixon, I'm sorry. I know how that sounds. Okay. But I mean, there was a visionary exerciser of the executive powers. You know, I know how it sounds, but I'm just saying maybe he wasn't really ready for the job. Maybe it was a presumption. Maybe it wasn't just the Norwegian Nobel Peace Prize awarding committee that was, I mean, presumption
well,
is really
I think everybody, by the way,
the
in Obama land was horrified, you know, when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. I think you can't put that on Obama. He was not happy about it. And
I'm not putting it on Obama. I'm saying the Nixon comparison is not without its humor.
I mean, here you have a guy who comes in. First of all, he commits criminal acts and gets kicked out of office. He also his management of the war in Southeast Asia leaves tens of thousands of Americans dead and results ultimately in the government of North Vietnam conquering South Vietnam. Is involved all over the world in all sorts of things that after the fact turn out to be either criminal or extremely counter to American national interests, whether you're talking about Chile or you're talking about OPEC. you're really, I mean, Nixon made the opening to China, which he deserves a lot of credit for, and which, of course, was facilitated because he didn't have Richard Nixon biting his leg as he tried to do it. But, you know, it's Obama's been in a series of knife fights, and he's done well in some, and he's done poorly in others.
I don't think anybody is going to ask Obama for his advice about doing anything on the world stage after he leaves office. I think a lot of people wanted to know what Richard Nixon thought about what to do at critical junctures in the evolution of world affairs, because they regarded him as a grand strategist in that regard. And I don't think anybody's going to think that about Barack Hussein Obama.
By and large, if you look at many of the things that Nixon was involved in, I think he deserves credit for restraint in some key areas and for opening up with China. And I'm not a foreign policy expert.
I'm making a very narrow point. Excuse me, Harold. I just want to make clear. I'm making a very narrow point. I'm obviously not endorsing Richard Nixon as the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it's one thing to have the kind of acumen about the mm-hmm. strategizing of international affairs to be able to handle mm-hmm. an Arab Spring when it comes along. And it's another thing not to have it. And I'm saying, in my judgment, based upon what it is that I know about the history, Richard Nixon at least was in the club of people who might have had it. And
well,
Barack,
you know,
Obama is not.
I don't know. I guess I don't know what is possible right now in an era of declining American influence, in an era of profoundly complicated problems. I do think that. It is hard to be happy when I look at a situation like what's happening in Syria. But I also think that it is a bad moment to be at the helm of American foreign policy. And it is particularly coming in and having to wind down two extremely unsuccessful wars. It's actually kind of tragic the way when we look at what's happening in Iraq now. I think you'll have to talk to someone who is much more expert than I am. It's a tough moment. I mean, it's a moment of the rise of China. It's a moment of trying to somehow extricate ourselves from. I think the Iraq War has turned out to be a world historic blunder that has damaged American credibility in every possible way, and that let loose a set of forces that no one quite knows, you know, what to do with,
I agree with that.
So then you have the Arab-Israeli conflict, which I think we are, I'm very pessimistic about that as well. But let me shift over to something just in myself, just since the world really revolves around me.
Let's make this the last thing. Excuse me, Harold. Yeah. I'm going to have to terminate the conversation in a few minutes because I have another appointment.
I do find it very liberating not to be involved with any particular candidate. And, you know, I was thinking, go ahead.
Okay. I want to say something. Yeah.
Okay.
So then I'll get the last word. Hillary Rodham Clinton. Okay, so now people who follow Blogging Heads know that 6.5 years ago, I was a supporter of mm-hmm. Hillary Rodham Clinton. No, yes.
Okay.
No, not quite 6.5 years ago. Yeah, 6 years ago or so. And in the primary campaign, she lost out to Barack Obama. So now she's on the docket maybe to be, in the hunt again for the presidency. The idea that a woman would be elected president of the United States, that's one woman. Yep. She's not the only one. But were she to become a candidate, she would have a chance of being elected, yep. A good chance, is very exciting to me. That's something that I could get excited about. Mm-hmm. That's enough to get me out of my chair. So
there you go.
I might even knock on the door.
Well, you know, I hope that I would wish her well. But I feel very liberated by not having to. There was just something in the paper about Bill Clinton has earned $104 million giving speeches. And I was reading that.
Yeah,
and,
you know,
I mean, it's obviously unseemly. Yeah. It's not the worst thing in the world, but it's obviously unseemly. And I was thinking, you know, if I were reading that about Barack Obama 6 years ago, I would have been reading that, and or if I were reading that about Hillary Clinton 6 years ago, I would be reading it unavoidably from a sort of tactical lens and thinking about, you know, where does this – how do I respond to this as a piece of political work? You know, what – and I just find it very liberating not to have to – that's not my – that's not – I don't have to set aside a piece of my cerebrum for that.
I'm happy for you, Harold. I'm happy. I'm sorry to have to cut you short, so, but we got to
nice
go. Good to – we covered a lot of ground, Harold. I'm going
to
get hate mail. I know it. But
it's
won't
great
be
to
from
talk
you.
To you. Bye-bye.